Is everyone pretty much done? Any requests for more time? Good to go? Sending this away. You want to go through them, or you're more or less happy with what you've got? Yes, no? No? Okay, so that's the winner hexagon, 8 stars. Betelgeuse, Rigel, Aldebaran, Capella, Castor, Pollux, Procyon, Sirius. And Thursday we'll do the Summer Triangle, and that's pretty much the list then of all of those stars that you need to know for the exam, which is then right before Thanksgiving, wherever it is, there it is, Monday. Help session, kind of problematic for a Monday exam. I don't know if you want to think about it for another day or not. I think that Saturday is going to be the best day, and that's of course a terrible day. And it could be kind of in the morning, or unlikely in the afternoon, or at night. I don't know what would possibly work best on a day as bad as Saturday. Other days like Friday or Thursday are fine with me too, but I think that those are even less likely to work than Saturday, but maybe I'm wrong. Decide now, decide Thursday. Decide now. So am I right in thinking that no one wants to do it Friday or Thursday? So people are kind of caught on Saturday. I suspect the main difference is whether you want to do it, say, in the morning at 10 or 11, or whether you want to do it in the evening at, say, 6, 7, 8. I suspect people don't want to do it in the afternoon. Am I right in that? No one wants to do it in the afternoon. Okay, so who's for Saturday morning? Lots of people. Who's for Saturday evening? 3 people. So Saturday morning, any particular time? When are people awake on Saturday? 10, I think we're probably thinking 10 or 11. Is there a preference between 10 and 11? 11 is better? Okay, 11. Saturday at 11. On to more chapters. So we had night labs clear night last night, hopefully another clear night on Wednesday, and then we'll be done with the labs at the observatory. But you've got home labs that are due before Thanksgiving. There's some observations that you would need to do for to finishing off the second lab and a good number of calculations. So don't put it off to the day before it's due is my suggestion. Questions on any of that sort of stuff? Okay, so we've been talking about what's called stellar evolution, but it's the aging of stars, not evolution in the biological sense. And stars change because their composition changes. And it changes because of nuclear fusion. So if stars had the same mass and the same composition throughout time, they would have the same luminosity, according to Russell and Voigt. But what's happening, for example, in the sun is the composition that started out dominant hydrogen is gradually being cooked into dominant helium in the core, and that's changing the mass and luminosity of the sun. And we have kind of a funny way of showing the mass, the changes in the luminosity and temperature and radius of stars. That's the HR diagram. So these arrows don't represent motion, they represent changes in temperature, luminosity, and radius for a star like the sun. So the kind of the cooking process, we know from the bend in the binding energy curve that we can release nuclear energy by taking anything that's smaller than iron and building it up. That's fusion, and we can get energy out by taking anything bigger than iron and breaking it down. That is to say, iron is the most stable stuff. We start with hydrogen, so fusion is the logical thing. And we've talked last time, last exam time, about the proton-proton chain. That's what's required to operate the sun. You don't need to know that for this exam, but you need to know that for the final. We talked yesterday about the proton, about the CNO cycle. And I guess I don't want you to memorize all those reactions, but you should know that the CNO cycle is a slightly different set of reactions that operate in stars that are a little bit more massive than the sun. But the net result of either of those two reactions are that four hydrogens get together to form helium, which is called an alpha particle, and in the process it releases on two occasions an antimatter electron, which is called a positron, and a neutrino. And we can actually measure those neutrinos, for example, from the sun. So the next step, after we've used up all the hydrogen, we can do what's called helium burning. And I use that word burning in a metaphorical sense, right? Usually burning in the context of humans refers to rapid oxidation, that is to say a chemical reaction. Here we're talking about nuclear reactions. So what happens here is that two helium nuclei come together and they form for an instant the unstable nucleus of beryllium-8. Beryllium-8 can't exist for more than about a nanosecond before it breaks apart. So during the instant when it's formed, we have to hit it with another alpha particle to form the stable nucleus, which is carbon-12, the sort of carbon that you're made out of. So we need really high densities and temperatures in order to run this reaction. High temperatures because, you know, just like pushing two north poles is hard to do, pushing two alpha particles is hard to do because they both have a positive charge. And it's harder to push together, four times harder to push together two alphas than it is to push together two protons, so you have to have even higher temperatures in order to make that reaction go. Okay, well, we're not to iron yet. We can have two carbons combine to form neon. That's called carbon burning. We can have neon combine with alpha particles to form magnesium. And it can also be partially broken apart into oxygen-16. That's called neon burning. And we also have oxygen burning, where two oxygens get together to form silicon. And I kind of don't care whether you know those precise nuclear reactions or not, just know kind of what's roughly happening. We're building up more and more complicated stuff on our way to iron. And these things require higher temperatures because they have greater positive charge in the nucleus, so you have to throw them together harder than you would, say, protons. So it's sequential for that reason, right? More positive charge requires higher temperatures. The thermo of thermonuclear is reminding you that it's temperatures that are causing this reaction, in contrast to fission bombs, right? The bomb that was exploded over Hiroshima, while it was hot, it didn't need the high temperature in order for the reaction to go. It works just fine at room temperature for a few seconds, well, for a few nanoseconds. Virial theorem, we've run into lots of times. It's kind of the key process for all of this. And it's a theorem, it's got an if part and a then part. If you're made out of a normal gas, and we learned a couple of times ago what the alternative is. The alternative is a degenerate gas. So if you're made of a normal gas and held together by gravity, then if you lose energy, the temperature is going to increase and you're going to get a more compact object, a higher density object. And what that means is that, generally speaking, stars are going to be moving this way on this graph of temperature and density. If we're on this side of the degeneracy line and we run out of nuclear energy, Virial theorem guarantees we're going to go that away. The only times we can actually cool off is if we're in the degenerate state. And we know that degenerate states are also a little bit dangerous states because there's potential for explosion. But of course, in order to have explosion, you have to have an ignition temperature sort of situation, right? The sugar on your table, you don't have to worry about it burning because it's below the temperature that's required to start that reaction. But once it starts, it's going to continue. Okay, and the Russell-Voigt theorem that says that mass and composition say all, and you know, for a while we've had this idea that higher mass gives you to higher luminosity, and that means that big stars have much shorter lifetimes than low mass stars. So what we went through in detail is applying all of that stuff to the stages of a star like the sun. And you really need to be able to talk about the sun in terms of this graph, in terms of this graph, and in terms of the back side of that graph, right, which is, where's one that's clean? This one, right? This this is the one that's easiest to explain, and maybe this is the one to start. So here is the temperature and density of a star like the Sun. Here we're currently below the helium, the hydrogen ignition temperature, so we're talking about a protostar that is collapsing, and because of the virial theorem, and because it's a star, it's losing energy that's not being replaced by nuclear energy. So the virial theorem guarantees it's going to get hotter and denser in its core. Here we reach the temperatures for hydrogen burning, and here's where we're going to sit for the next 10 billion years. Almost all of the lifetime of the Sun is spent is quietly burning hydrogen to helium in the core. We've got lots of hydrogen, and hydrogen releases the most energy in a single step than any of these other fusion reactions. So this is where most of the time is spent, right at that dot, with a density about 10 times that of lead and a temperature of 15 million degrees or so, happily burning hydrogen to helium. But when we run out of hydrogen fuel, according to the virial theorem, we're going to get higher temperature and higher density, and we cross over into the degeneracy area. So this is a little bit dangerous. We could cool off, and stars lower mass than the Sun do cool off, or we could get hot enough to burn helium to carbon. And we do that in a degenerate state, and we have an explosion at the center of the Sun. It's a totally contained explosion. If you were sitting outside the Sun, you wouldn't notice anything at all. But in a few seconds, a good fraction of the helium is burned, and we move over after that explosion to the non-degenerate gas, normal gas, happily, stably burning helium to carbon. There's only so much helium around. We're going to use up that helium. We're going to get hotter and denser. We cross the line that represents degeneracy. And in this case, we don't get hot enough to burn carbon to other things, and we cool off in terms of a white dwarf. Question? So the first thing is it's different for different mass stars. So say again?
It's still millions of years after they've
done hydrogen. So maybe a million years, maybe even a little bit shorter than a million years would be a reasonable guess. So this stage, which is this stage here, so we're puffing off the outer layers of the star with these thermal pulses, becoming a planetary nebula, and then finally, the white dwarf has kind of always been there, but it's been obscured by this cloud of opaque gas. When that gas clears, then we can actually see the white dwarf. So this planetary nebula stage is relatively short-lived, 10,000 years, 30,000 years, something like that. These thermal pulses go on for more like hundreds of thousands of years. So maybe from here to there, maybe a million years. This cooling off process is very slow, billions of years. So there are white dwarfs that are as cool as the Sun, but they're relatively rare. Most of them are still quite hot. And none of them are as cool as M stars, say. So it's this process here that's relatively fast. Ben, you thought you had a question or not? Okay, so from the outside, so we know the protostar stage. We start large radius cool. We go down and kind of up to the main sequence, and then here we start hydrogen burning, and this is where we spend almost all of the time. Everything else is kind of short change. We go into an inert helium core surrounded by a shell of burning hydrogen. So this is where we're becoming a giant star, hydrogen shell burning. Here's the helium flash that we just mentioned. Oddly enough, nothing, you know, from one day to the next post-helium flash, nothing much is going to change. So over maybe a million years, we're going to slowly increase in surface temperature, decrease in radius, and reach what's called the horizontal branch, where we have helium burning to carbon in the core, surrounded by inert helium, surrounded by a shell of hydrogen burning to helium, surrounded by inert hydrogen. We're going to use up all of that helium. And you notice that every time we use up something in the core and go to shell burning, that's when we go to a giant stage. So when we go to single shell burning of hydrogen, we go up. When we go to double shell burning, we go up. And here we reach the asymptotic giant stage.
So right at the top right corner, what form are solar systems?
So people argue about how big the sun will be, whether it will encompass the Earth or not, and it's kind of hard to say whether it'll actually encompass the Earth. It'll at least come close, and so Venus and Mercury will be inside the sun, the sun's visible surface. So the sun at this point will be a star kind of like Betelgeuse, hugely luminous, hugely cold, hugely big, and the planets will probably still be orbiting around them. And actually Venus may still be orbiting around at least for a good million years inside of the sun. So there's going to be air friction that'll slowly spiral it in, but probably not anything like immediately. Because remember, the outer layers of these stars are not that dense gas. Turns out that there are a couple of processes that are happening. The mass loss that occurs at this time tends to make the planetary orbits bigger, and the air friction that you might have if you're intersecting the atmosphere tends to make the orbit smaller. So we think net-net the Earth's orbit will move out a little bit. Not a lot, but a little bit.
And then when it pops off and stuff, what's that going to do to the planets?
So first of all, let me make it clear that we're toast way back here, right? Life has ended on the planet probably in about a billion years just from this gradual increase in temperature and luminosity of the sun. So So I guess you're questioning, are they going to become molten balls or something like that?
And what happens in that puffing off process?
Well, so these puffs are pretty rarefied. So it's not like these puffs are going to throw the planets out in any great way. And just the gradual loss of mass leads to an increase in orbit. Not a huge increase in orbit, but you know, a 10% increase in orbit of these planets. And probably Jupiter and Saturn wouldn't be much affected by this process. So it's mostly the inner rocky planets that would be destroyed by this process. And this puffing off is a fairly gentle process. It's not like an explosion. But like I say, we're dead way back here, right? So presumably you could go out to the asteroid belt. In some place it must be habitable in the solar system. And all of these processes are pretty slow, so you know, you can build stuff in 100,000 years, presumably, without much trouble if you wanted to. Planetary nebula cooling off white dwarf. And see these same processes in these graphs here where we show the inside of stars. And again, remember here, because the radius of the star changes dramatically, they haven't shown that. They've just shown the same constant size circle. That doesn't mean that the star has the same radius. That is not the case. Instead, they're just allowing you to see what's going on. So questions on the Earth? So we're going to talk more about today, but we touched on last time what's happening to the more massive stars. So there's nothing to keep them. The virial theorem is going to get hotter and hotter and hotter. They're going to enter each burning stage in the non-degenerate normal gas state, so it's all going to be stable. They're going to end up with shells of hydrogen burning to helium, helium burning to carbon, and actually this thing doesn't show neon burning to oxygen, oxygen burning to silicon, building up to iron, which is the lowest energy state, and so there's nothing more that you can do with that iron core. In the case of the stars that have lower mass, so remember there's this branching on this graph, in the case of the stars that have lower mass, none of them have died yet, because they have hugely long lifetimes, but they will gradually cook themselves from hydrogen into helium without going through a red giant phase. Okay, questions? Okay, so one of the things I want to bring to your mind is, kind of whether I've been lying to you. So remember we had this mantra that high temperatures broke apart composites. But we seem to be having exactly the opposite effect, right? We are having higher temperatures, but we're building up composites. We're making things as big as iron. So let me comment that that's only a temporary sort of situation. If the temperature were even higher, we'll see the iron will break apart. So the other thing that's kind of a little bit confusing is why there are any leftovers from the Big Bang. So the Big Bang had tremendously hot temperatures. why didn't all of these reactions occur then? Why did it leave all these tasty bits for us to eat in the way of starlight and form life? Why wasn't all of this matter consumed in the Big Bang, since we had arbitrarily high temperatures at that time? So those are kind of questions to consider for the future. What I want to at least touch on to start with is this sort of diagram, which is emphasizing where we came from. So we're going to argue that the universe started with hydrogen and helium. It didn't have any of the carbon, the calcium, the iron that's in your bodies. So all of that had to be made inside stars. So we know that from the interstellar medium, we can have stars collapse that have masses that are less than about a tenth of the mass of the sun, and those things never are going to ignite hydrogen burning, and they're going to end up as objects, kind of like Jupiter, that are now forever sequestered. They are made out of degenerate gas, so they can cool, and they do cool, and there's no future for them. Right? We've seen that main sequence stars, they have things like solar winds and this thermal processing cycle, which, here we are, which is going to throw back some material into the interstellar medium. And a star like the sun is going to end up throwing off 30-40% of its material in the process of dying. So it's not that the white dwarf that we end up with at the end of the sun's life has used up all of that material and sequestered it. A good fraction of it, you know, not 50% of it, but maybe 30% of it, 40% of it, is going to be recycled into the interstellar medium. And what's important to recognize is that some of it is going to be material that has been processed. That is to say, it's not the hydrogen or helium that's at the surface, it's stuff that has been changed by these sort of nuclear reactions. So what we need to talk about are what are called dredge-ups. So those are situations where processed material comes to the surface. So if you look at I'm not sure I've emphasized it, but in these diagrams we've been looking at, what this kind of fish scale indicates is convection. So here we have a star like the sun, and you remember that the sun is convective on the outside, right? The outer 30% of the sun is boiling, as it were, but the inside is still material. So that means that currently, the helium that's building up in the core of the sun, we don't see it on the surface of the sun, because there is still material that is separating us from it. So in order to get processed material up, we have to have convection that is reaching down into the core and bring some of that material to the surface, and then that material can be blown off, reach the interstellar media, and end up in the next generation of stars and planets and in you. So these sort of situations where we have dredge up are of particular interest. And there are several situations where we have dredge up. Most of them are not of great interest. That is to say, when we have a red giant, we have the first stage of dredge up, but this is not going to go all the way down into the core. It's not going to bring up extra amounts of helium. What it does do is bring up material that has undergone a little bit of the CNO cycle, and so the ratios of carbon and nitrogen and oxygen have been changed from what they might be otherwise. They're going to be the ratios that we have in the CNO cycle, as opposed to the original material. Right? The carbon is acting as a catalyst, and it's going to end up as a mixture of carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. So the kind of important parts of dredge up is actually the third dredge up that happens in the asymptotic giant stage. Then we can have carbon that is brought up from the area where helium burning has occurred, and we can get stars that have enriched amount of carbon on their surface, way larger amounts of carbon than we have in the sun. So these are called carbon stars. And they tend to spit out basically soot. They're very cool and huge stars. Oops. So we have carbon making it into the interstellar medium through the process of these stars. These stars are often what are called long-term variables. So let's talk for a minute about variable stars. What can we measure from stars? Well, Hipparchos could measure the location of stars. You can measure the brightness of stars. Hipparchus gave us the magnitude system, but none of that really helps us understand stars very much. We can measure the proper motion of stars, how stars' position location has changed over the centuries. That gives us statistical hints about the distance to those stars, so that's helpful. We can measure the color of stars, right? If we measure their magnitude through a blue filter and through a visible filter, we can get the actual color of that star, and that gives us a hint about the temperature of stars. If we have time, we can take a whole spectra of a star, in which case we can get the chemical composition of the star and a really good measurement of the temperature of a star. So there are only so many measurements we can make on stars if they don't change, right? So variable stars allow us to make a new sort of measurement. How is the brightness of that star changing with time? And this is something that I do pretty commonly at the observatory is look at variable stars. And I've looked at long-term variables in particular. So long-term is a human scale statement, not an astronomical scale statement. So we're typically talking about stars that are varying on a fraction of a year time scale, you know, maybe 3 months. And these are stars that expand out, puff off gas, and they may increase in, they're actually mostly bright in the infrared, but they can change in their infrared brightness by many magnitudes, 3 or 4 magnitudes, but more commonly, I guess, about 1 magnitude, during a month in the process of this kind of puffing off of carbon dust. So there's another sort of variable that I study that is of interest, and these are Cepheid variable stars. Right, so you know the constellation Cepheus. The first example of this was Delta in Cepheus. So now the whole class of stars are called Cepheids. These are stars that balloon in and out, and they typically have a temperature that is kind of in the A to F region. So here's where we have various types of evolved stars that are going through a cycle of ballooning in and out, typically days to maybe a month in terms of their time frame. So their brightness just goes up and down cyclically. Turns out the one I mostly study has a period of about 4 days. And what's particularly important about Cepheid stars is that the time it takes to go through a cycle tells you how bright they are. And if you know how bright they are, if you know their absolute magnitude, then you can get the distance to those stars. And remember that distance is one of the most important things that we try and measure. Right, so these are stars that literally balloon in and out. Time frame, as I say, days to months. The particular one I study has about a 4-day cycle. They typically have temperatures that are in kind of the AF range. And they're generally speaking giant or supergiant stars. And that's important because that means they're relatively bright, so we can see them at a distance. And so the important fact is the period tells us the luminosity. And if we know the luminosity, then we can calculate the absolute magnitude and we can get the distance modulus. So for stars that are beyond what we can use parallax for, we have a way of getting distance using these Cepheid variable stars. There's kind of one fly in the ointment, and that is that it turns out there are two classes of Cepheid variable stars, type 1 and type 2. And you remember I've said that stars all have pretty much the same composition? It's all surface composition I'm talking about. So 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and maybe a few percent else. The difference between the class 1 and the class 2 is in that amount of else. So the type 1s are stars like the Sun that have, you know, 1 or 2% else. The type 2s are stars that have maybe a hundredth of a percent of else. They have less else. So these guys contain more pristine material, unprocessed material, whereas these stars have been polluted by this process that we talked about, where processed material is returned to the interstellar media from which new stars then form. Right? So this is a schedule for pollution, right? We start with interstellar material that has zero else in it. We go through a cycle and we've built up a certain amount of the carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, all of the else stuff. So the next generation of stars will have more else, and so it goes. So we can kind of get a handle on the age of a star based on how polluted it is. And the Sun is not a first generation star. It's in this so-called population 1 stars that have a few percent else. So these are the ones that have pretty small amounts of else. There's a hypothetical class, they haven't actually been detected yet, that have zero metals in them. So recently, a cloud of type 3 material was detected, but there's great interest in seeing the first generation of stars, but it hasn't occurred yet. These R.R. Leary stars are similar sorts of pulsing stars that have a period more like a fraction of a day. And they're mostly distinguished by where they are. They're mostly found in globular clusters. Okay, so we've previously talked about eclipsing binary stars, and that brings to mind Algol. Where's my picture of eclipsing binary stars? Maybe I never got it out. So remember, with eclipsing binary stars, we have stars that are moving in front of each other, and so the light gets dimmed when that sort of thing occurs. And Algol is a standard example of an eclipsing binary star. And you remember, the other nice thing about binary stars is that if we can get the distance to them, we can get the mass. And so we can do that with Algol. And if you remember, Algol was a combination of a main sequence B star and an evolved K star. And we know that the more massive stars evolve faster. Presumably the binary stars formed at the same time. So this star that is in the process of dying, you would think that this would have the most mass. Because it's dying first. Right? And this guy must have been born at pretty much the same time. But that's not the case. So we can actually measure the mass of these stars, and it turns out that this guy is the most massive star. So what's going on? How can it be that the most massive star is the least evolved? Since I've told you lots of times that the more massive stars evolve first. Well, so what we can have is mass transfer. And I want to introduce the word Roche-Loeb, if I can find my transparency. Oh, here it is. So here's kind of the picture. So let me first write down this word Roche-Loeb. Roche is a person. So I take it it's no surprise if you take a hammer and you stand on the moon and you drop it, it falls to the moon and not to the earth. And if I go outside and drop a hammer, it falls to the earth. So imagine doing that all over the region between the earth and the moon. And you might guess that if you are relatively close to the moon, if you drop the hammer, it's going to fall to the to the moon, and if you drop the hammer here, it's going to fall to the Earth. But if you're far enough, if you're far enough away, it's not going to fall to either of those places. So the set of locations where a dropped hammer falls on the central object, that's the Roche lobe, an imaginary line in the sky that divides where something will fall to the planet and when it would move out from the planet. Okay? So here we have the situation where we have a more massive star and a least massive star, and here's the Roche lobe. This little X is actually marking the center of mass between these two stars, so they would both, of course, be going around in circles about this point. This star is going to evolve first, since it's the most massive one, so it's going to evolve into a giant star, and in the process, it's going to dump material onto this star. And so we end up with a situation where actually more mass is transferred than this guy had originally. So what was originally the least massive star becomes the most massive star. So here we end up with an evolved low-mass star next to an unevolved high-mass star, exactly the Algol situation. And of course, the future is that this guy is going to evolve, so it's going to dump material back onto to this guy. Okay. No, because typically once somebody has evolved into, say, a white dwarf, there's no future for it, right? But we do have to worry a little bit about what's going to happen if we keep dumping material onto a white dwarf. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So let me put that aside to be talked about in 5 minutes and to be worried about what happens. So we can see this cycle works fine as long as they're stars, but when they're degenerate objects, we know that dangerous things happen to degenerate objects. They have the potential for explosion. Okay, so that's actually what I want to talk about next, are novas, which are binary stars in this sort of situation where we're going to have an explosion. But before I do that, I need to talk a little bit more about white dwarfs. Because a nova has exactly the situation where we have this sort of thing. We have the ember of a star like the sun, a white dwarf, and a star that is in the process of dumping material onto that star. So if we're thinking about a white dwarf, the case of the sun, it's going to lose a lot of mass, so it's going to be an object that has a mass of, say, 0.6 times the mass of the current mass of the sun. And it's a very compact object. It has a radius that is comparable to the radius of the Earth, right? It's highly dense material, which is about 1/100th of the current radius of the sun. And the book would say it's supported by degeneracy pressure. I'm not particularly fond of the word degenerate pressure. It's certainly made out of a degenerate gas, and the gas we're talking about are the electrons. There's going to be some sort of processed material. In the case of the sun, there's going to be carbon and oxygen nuclei that are also rushing around in this ionized gas, but it's the electrons that are doing most of the work. It's the electrons that are moving fast and are producing the pressure that's supporting these stars. And these guys happily can cool off, right? Because they're not subject to the virial theorem because they're made out of a degenerate gas. But they have a lot of odd properties. So the first odd property is if you double the recipe for your cake, you expect the cake to be twice as big, right? And that's not true for white dwarfs. If you increase the mass of a white dwarf, the radius actually gets smaller. So the extra mass leads to extra compression, so we get an even smaller radius even though there's less mass. But you can see that process can only continue so long, right? So it turns out that there's a maximum possible mass for a white dwarf. White dwarf's more massive than about 1.4 times the current mass of the sun. They can't exist. They will have to collapse into something else. So this is called the Chandrasekhar mass limit. Well, good luck on me spelling Chandrasekhar. R-A-S-E. Chandra. People just called him Chandra. So he's obviously Indian, but he did most, well, he's a very interesting character, and there are lots of biographies of him. So he came from India and studied at Cambridge, and in the 1920s and 30s, by far preeminent astrophysicist was a guy named Eddington. And Eddington and Chandrasekhar were working kind of together, and Chandrasekhar developed this theory that there was a maximum mass for white dwarfs of 1.4 times the mass of the sun. And kind of his boss and much more famous guy, Eddington, disagreed with him. So there was a famous argument between Chandrasekhar and Eddington in which the famous white guy was very wrong and the brown smart guy was very right. So it took a while to resolve it. So for a good for 20 years probably, astronomy thought that Eddington was right and Chandrasekhar was wrong. Chandrasekhar eventually moved to the University of Chicago, where he had a long career, including getting the Nobel Prize for exactly this work. I think that's enough said about Chandrasekhar. He died somewhat recently, maybe 10 years ago. Okay, so there's an upper limit to the size of a mass, to the mass of a white dwarf, and you have kind of funny situations where the most massive white dwarf is the least luminous, right? Because it's going to be physically smaller. So usually we think of more mass as making something brighter, but not for white dwarfs. More mass will make them physically smaller and hence dimmer. So why is there an upper limit to the mass of a white dwarf, which is kind of related to the reason why does the radius get smaller when you add more mass onto it? And I certainly can't go through the details today, but the answer has to do with the speed of light speed limit. So as you compress the gas more and more, it turns out that the electrons end up going faster and faster and faster, but they can't go faster than the speed of light. And that fundamental limitation is what leads to this problem. And it was this disagreement about how relativity worked which was behind the Eddington-Chandrasekhar controversy, which is ironic because Eddington, at one point somebody from The Guardian interviewed Eddington about Einstein's theory of general relativity, which we also haven't talked about yet. And the reporter asked Eddington, supposedly only four people in the world understand Einstein's theory. And Eddington thought for a while, and the reporter said, well, what are you thinking about? I'm trying to think about who the other three are. So he really did understand Einstein's theory of relativity. He kind of wrote the first book in English on Einstein's theory of relativity. So you would have thought he would have gotten relativistic things correct, but he kind of went off the rails on this one. Chandrasekhar did okay with his career anyway, but he did leave England, which helped. So this property of a mass limit, we'll see, kind of doesn't depend on what the gas is. So in this case, it's electrons, but if we had a star made out of degenerate gas of something else, it would also have an upper limit to its mass. And I don't think we'll get to it today. It's actually the topic of chapter 21. That's the case of neutron stars. So neutron stars are kind of the next smallest thing that you can make. So if you add a clod of dirt onto something that's the Chandrasekhar mass limit, it'll get smaller and smaller and smaller and collapse to zero size. And it turns out what's happening is the electrons are going extremely high energy. And it turns out it becomes energetically possible to do the following. The electrons can be eaten by protons, and in the process form neutrons, and a neutrino is given off in the process. So usually the opposite reaction is what we see on Earth. If you had a neutron that was sitting in a bottle and you waited about 1,000 seconds, it would spontaneously decay into a proton and an antimatter electron and a neutrino. But under the conditions where the electrons have extremely high energy, kind of the reverse reaction is what occurs. And so we can convert the protons that are in the carbon and oxygen that are making up the nuclei and the electrons into neutrons. So we get a very compact object, an object that has a size that's about 10 kilometers. Right? So this thing here is like 10,000 kilometers in size. So we go down by a factor of 1,000 in terms of radius. So that's a factor of 1 billion in terms of density. So here we have, I don't know, there isn't a good word, stupendously high density. And in this case, the gas that we're talking about is a neutron gas. It's not a pure neutron gas. Maybe 10% of it is in the form of protons and electrons that haven't been converted. But 90% neutrons. And those neutrons are the things that's supporting that very compact object against gravity. But the same thing happens if you add mass to a neutron star. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller until we reach the equivalent of the Chandrasekhar mass limit. It turns out it's difficult to calculate because the nuclear force becomes extremely important at these high densities. But, I don't know, something like 2 times or 3 times the mass of the sun is the most mass that we can have in a neutron star. And if you add a piece of chalk to a neutron star that is at its equivalent to the Chandrasekhar mass limit, then it has to go to something that's smaller still. And the only thing that's more compact than a neutron star is a black hole. Okay, so in terms of compact degenerate objects, so these are the only possible end states of stars, because if it's not degenerate, if you leave it alone, it's going to get hotter, and so it's not dead yet. So the only way you can die is by a degenerate gas. We have white dwarfs in which the gas is a gas of electrons. We still have nuclei floating around with those electrons. We're thinking about something comparable to the size of the Earth. Starts out extremely hot, hundreds of thousands of degrees, but it'll cool off over time. No big deal. It takes a long time for them to cool off because they've got a lot of mass that's hot. Upper mass limit determined by Chandrasekhar, something like 1.4 times the mass of the sun. And we can weigh a lot of white dwarfs. And I said that most typically we have white dwarfs that are about 0.6 times the mass of the sun. They come smaller, they come bigger. I think the biggest known white dwarf is about 1.2 times the mass of the sun. The problem, of course, is it's hard to measure the mass of anything. But presumably, if those things got a little bit bigger, they would have to collapse into a neutron star. Something that's the size of a city, say 10 kilometers in radius, still would have the mass of the sun, so 1.4 times the mass of the sun, and that's supported by degenerate neutrons. Same thing happens as we add mass to a neutron star. The neutrons become relativistic, and turns out that under those circumstances, they can't support the star against further collapse. So there's some upper limit to the mass of a neutron star, say 2 or 3 times the mass of the sun. And beyond that, the only thing that could happen is a black hole. And we talked a little bit about black holes before, but let me fill in a few of the details. So kind of the defining characteristic of a black hole is that nothing can escape, right? So we know that the escape velocity from the Earth, well, I can put in the two, depends on the mass and radius of the object. And if we have more mass at smaller radius, the escape velocity is going to get higher and higher and higher, and eventually it'll reach the speed of light, and nothing will be able to escape. So what we have then is a radius from which nothing can escape. And that's, when people talk about the size of a neutron star, that's what they're talking about, because we're not going to know anything about anything that's inside of that. This is called the Schwarzschild radius, after the German Schwarzschild who died on the front in World War I in calculating this. So if you were to compress the sun into a black hole, the Schwarzschild radius would be about 3 kilometers. So smaller, but not hugely smaller than a neutron star. A neutron star is almost a black hole. It has an escape, typically would have an escape velocity that might be 10% of the speed of light. So we can never know what's going on inside of a Schwarzschild radius, because nothing's ever going to escape from in there. But in theory, the mass is all concentrated in a single point. So we're thinking about something like the mass of the sun collapsed to a single mathematical point. It can't literally be like that, I think I told you before, but that's what current theory would say. So we know that current theory, Einstein's theory, has to be wrong in detail in dealing with these incredible sorts of situations. But how to correct Einstein's theory has been a problem that Einstein himself worked on for, well, from 1917 to his death in about, I think, 1957. So it's the problem of quantum gravity, an unsolved problem. And it's the problem that string theory is supposed to solve, but it certainly hasn't solved it yet. Okay, so if we go back to this kind of picture of the evolution of the stuff that makes up the solar system. What we've said is, from the interstellar material, low mass things are sequestered forever in brown dwarfs. Things like the sun, they die by producing a planetary nebula. A good fraction of the sun's mass is recycled into the interstellar medium, but we're left with a white dwarf, which eventually cools. None of them have cooled off to black dwarfs yet, but if we wait long enough, they'll cool off to black dwarfs. And that's material that's forever sequestered from the interstellar media. More massive stars, they're going to die by producing either neutron stars or black holes, depending upon the mass of the guy itself. In the process of these things, very large fractions, 90% of the material might be thrown back out into the interstellar media from which new stars are going to form. Okay. Now, I think I started this by saying that convection plays an important role, right? Because convection is what's required in order to get processed material from inside of the star outside of the star. And I can't find the bigger version of this. And you remember that there's kind of an important difference between low mass stars like the sun and more massive stars. The sun is radiative on the inside and convective on the outside, and these more massive stars are convective on the inside. It has to do really with the behavior of the CNO cycle. And they're radiative on the outside. So that means that in the case of the sun, we get the most helium burning at the core, and we get less and less and less helium burning as we move out from the core. And so we get kind of a helium shell that really doesn't have sharp boundaries. So the helium concentration might be 100% at the sun, and you go out 1,000 kilometers and maybe it's 98%. There's not a sharp boundary to the helium mixture. In this case, all of this material is well mixed, so it'll be cooked uniformly into a helium shell. So here we will get a pretty sharp boundary between the processed material and the unprocessed material. So when we have a shell that eventually forms for shell burning, it'll have a very definite region that surrounds it before it goes to these kind of onion-shaped stars that we've been talking about. Okay. So let's go back to our binary star then. And so here we have the setup that we've described. More massive star, less massive star. This guy expands, dumps mass on what was the previously least massive star. So we end up with an evolved low mass star and a main sequence major star. In this particular scenario, this guy is going to supernova. Right, so we know that we can't go anything beyond iron. We're going to have an explosion. And we're going to have a black hole that's formed. When this guy expands, it's going to dump material onto this black hole. And if we dump material onto a black hole, once it goes through the Schwarzschild radius, we're never going to see it again. But in the process of going down there, that material will be heated to very high temperature. Right, a lot of energy will be given off in falling, you know, from this spot all the way down to 3 kilometers above the R equals zero point. And this is where we can get black holes as being an X-ray source. So the black holes that have quote unquote been seen astronomically have been in this sort of situation. We have a binary star, so we can measure the mass of the components. We have a source that is invisible to us, to visible light. And we can figure out that the mass of that is several times the mass of the sun. In one famous case I can think of, it's 5 times the mass of the sun. So an invisible object that is not producing much visible light but is producing X-ray light has a mass of 5 times the mass of the sun, so it can't be a neutron star. And we therefore interpret that we don't know anything that can weigh more than about twice the mass of the sun and not be a neutron and be a compact object except a black hole. So kind of by exclusion, we determine that this guy is a black hole. We can't actually see anything there, right? Because by definition, no light escapes from the Schwarzschild radius. But we have a compact object of high mass, and that's interpreted as a black hole. Okay, so that's one of the games we can play with compact objects, dumping mass on them. But probably the more important method is the nova that I started to talk about and have lost my transparency for it. Here it is. Nope. Now, I don't need a transparency to talk. Well, I wouldn't mind having this transparency. Nope, that's not the one I want. I give up. So, what's going on in a nova? So we've seen that if we have binary stars, it's pretty easy to end up with a situation where we have a collapsed object. Right? And it can be dead because it's degenerate. And we can have a neighboring star that is in the process of dumping material through its Roche lobe onto that small object. And the particular case I'm thinking about now is where this object is a white dwarf. So what's going to happen is we will start to accumulate a shell a few meters deep of hydrogen material that's come from the surface of that evolved star. and a white dwarf is hot and degenerate, those are situations that we can have for an explosion. And so when the material gets deep enough and hot enough, we can have an explosion that's on the surface of that white dwarf. So since this is an explosion on the surface, it's not going to disrupt the star system, but it is going to suddenly brighten, and then as the material dissipates, it's going to dim. Yeah, I wish I had my transparency of the brightness curve of a nova. And what's important here is that it can happen again and again and again, right? As 10 years later, another meter of material might have accumulated on the surface of the neutron star, and we can have another explosion. And so this can happen repeatedly at the same spot in the sky. In contrast, here it is, in contrast to a supernova. So here's the brightness curve of a nova in the constellation Cygnus. Brightens considerably and then just dims over time. And we're talking about a month sort of situation. Okay, so novas are situations where we have binary star system, compact object that's a white dwarf. The evolved star dumps material onto the white dwarf. It accumulates for a while. We get enough to have thermonuclear ignition from this degenerate gas on the surface of the white dwarf. It's an explosion on the surface, so it doesn't disrupt the star, but it brightens considerably while the explosion is in process. And we can actually see at this point material that's thrown off from the nova. And then it goes back to the original situation where it's building up more material. Okay, and we could do the same thing if we wanted to with a neutron star as the compact object. Of course, we can't do it with a black hole because there's no surface on which stuff could accumulate. Now, what we have to worry about is, was there net accumulation in this circumstance? Was 100% of the deposited material blown off in the explosion, or does that white dwarf now weigh a little more than it did before? Because if it is increasing in mass, eventually it will bump up against the Chandrasekhar mass limit. And it'll start to compress to a much smaller object, say something on the order of a neutron star. But in the process, the degenerate carbon and oxygen core can explode. So now we're not talking about a explosion on the surface of the star, we're talking about the interior of the star exploding, totally disrupting the star and producing a whole lot of light. So this is called a supernova. So historically, nova just meant new stars, and people saw a dot where there wasn't a dot in the past. The dot stayed around for a month and then it disappeared. And there wasn't a careful distinction between this sort of thing, which can occur repetitively at the same location, and while it's bright, it isn't super bright, and this sort of situation, which totally disrupts the star, it doesn't come back, and is a million times brighter than the nova sort of situation. They're both cases where a dot that previously wasn't visible in the sky brightens hugely. And a comment that, yeah, so some people who are out at the observatory looked at a supernova that is currently going on in M101. So supernovas turn out to be pretty rare. You might remember that Tycho was turned on to astronomy by seeing a supernova. There was another one, I think, a century after that. But there's been a big absence of bright supernovas for the last 500 years or so. And this is the first supernova that I've seen with my naked eye. Well, I shouldn't say my naked eye. I could see it with binoculars. It's not that bright. It's not in our galaxy. It's in a galaxy that is 20 million light years away. So it's surprising to see anything that's 20 million light years away. In 1987, there was another supernova a lot closer, about 150,000 light years away from us, But that was not the sort of object I've described. That was a different type of star that brightened considerably and in the process was exploded. And so that's what we'll talk about next time, is another way stars can explode, as the one did in 1987, as opposed to this white dwarf goes over the Chandrasekhar mass limit case, which is called a type 1A.